Turn today to the study of the book of Revelation. We're now prepared to begin the 10th chapter. We passed very rapidly over the 5th and 6th trumpets because we've done quite some study on this before in our searching out the great battle of Armageddon. Now today we want to begin the 10th chapter of the book of Revelation, which we haven't particularly studied in this group a great deal. And this opens the picture of the great Second Advent message in 1844. Read the chapter right through to begin with, and then we'll go back and begin to examine it verse by verse. And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with the cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head, and his face was as it were the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. And he had in his hand a little book open, and he set his right foot upon the sea, and his left foot upon the earth. And cried with a loud voice, as when a lion roareth, and when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. And when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, I was about to write, and I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered, and write them not. And the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand to heaven, and swear by him that liveth for ever and ever, who created heaven and the things that therein are, and the earth and the things that therein are, and the sea and the things which are therein, that there should be time no longer. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he hath declared to his servants the prophets. And the voice which I heard from heaven spake unto me, saying, spake unto me again, and said, go and take the little book which is open in the hand of the angel which standeth upon the sea and upon the earth. And I went unto the angel and said unto him, give me the little book. And he said unto me, take it and eat it up, and it shall make thy belly bitter, but it shall be in thy mouth sweet as honey. And I took the little book out of the angel's hand and ate it up, and it was in my mouth sweet as honey. And as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. And he said unto me, thou must prophesy again before many peoples, and nations, and tongues, and kings. Now first of all, the mighty angel who comes down from heaven is no other than Jesus Christ himself. Let's come back to the first verse in the chapter. I'd like to read to you the Spirit of Prophecy statement, which tells us that. It's quoted here in the Seventh-day Adventist Bible Commentary, volume 7, page 971. The mighty angel who instructed John was no less a personage than Christ himself. Setting his right foot on the sea and his left upon the dry land shows the part which he is acting in the closing scenes of the great controversy with Satan. This position denotes his supreme power and authority over the whole earth. The controversy has waxed stronger and more determined from age to age, and will continue to do so to the concluding scenes, when the masterly working of the powers of darkness shall reach their height. Satan, united with evil men, will deceive the whole world and the churches who receive not the love of the truth. But the mighty angel demands attention. He cries with a loud voice. He is to show the power and authority of his voice to those who have united with Satan to oppose the truth. So then the mighty angel who comes down from heaven and plants one foot upon the earth and the other upon the sea, and has in his hand this little book open, is no less a person than Jesus Christ himself. Now, we're well aware, without my proving this at this point in the study, that the 10th chapter of Revelation introduces the opening of the great second Advent message. Several evidences in the chapter, of course, make this very plain. The little book open, we understand to be the opening of the book of Daniel. The announcement that time should be no longer is the announcement that there would no longer be not probationary time, nor the end of the world, but the end of prophetic time. This I read again on the same page, where it says, this time, which the angel declares with a solemn oath, is not the end of this world's history, neither of probationary time, but of prophetic time, which should precede the advent of our Lord. That is, the people will not have another message upon definite time. After this period of time, reaching from 1842 to 1844, there can be no definite tracing of the prophetic time. The longest reckoning reaches to the autumn of 1844. So therefore, this declaration, there should be time no longer, is announcing the end of prophetic time. And as you know, of course, the great 2,300-day prophecy, or 2,300 years from 457 BC right down until 1844 AD, 2,300 days or years, is the longest prophetic period that is lined out in time anywhere in the Word of God. And all the other great prophetic periods are contained inside that. The 70 weeks of 490 years pressed down until AD 34, and then from 538 AD to 1798 AD, of course, we have the 1260 years of prophecy that we have there, and then the 1335 days extend from back here up till 1844, and the 1290 days extend from here up until 1798. So that all the great prophetic chains of the Bible are contained within the 2,300-day prophecy. And when time should be no longer, we're brought down to 1844, and at that point of time, when the angel said that, the prophet was instructed to go up and take the little book and eat it, which he did. In his mouth, it was sweet as honey, which is symbolic of the happy anticipation of the soon coming of Jesus, as between 1842, in particular 1844, they had the sweet anticipation of the early advent of Jesus Christ. But when they came to their great disappointment in 1844, at that point there, then the sweet experience was turned to a bitter one, as they were disappointed in the non-appearing of the Lord and Saviour Jesus Christ. The significance of 1844 is something which we never need to lose sight of. It is, in a very special sense, the opening of the last great conflict. As I read to you here a moment ago in the Adventist Bible Commentary, page 971 of volume 7, it says, "The mighty angel who instructed John was no less a personage than Jesus Christ. Setting his right foot upon the sea and his left upon the dry land shows the part which he is acting in the closing scenes of the great controversy with Satan." Now, he set his right foot upon the earth and the sea back in the 1844 period to show what?
The part
he is acting in the closing scenes of the great controversy with Satan. Then Sister White says, "The controversy has waxed stronger and more determined from age to age, and will continue to do so to the concluding scene when the masterly working of the powers of darkness shall reach their height." Now, during the past week, I've been very busy typing up the next four chapters of the Order of Last Day Events for the Messenger magazine. The plan being, of course, to complete them right through until December before I get away. It is almost impossible to write them when I'm traveling. And naturally, of course, as you restudy these things, you see vistas of truth which you have not seen before. And I have been strongly impressed with the picture of this great controversy down to the ages. Now, I'd like to spend a few moments today, before we enter this chapter properly, just laying out before you these sobering thoughts, so we shall better appreciate the role that we are to play in the great controversy, and better appreciate just what God is trying to do and just what Satan is trying to do. Now, as we look back through history, through the great controversy, we find that we have these two protagonists, God and righteousness on the one hand, and Satan and evil on the other hand, locked in a deadly conflict with each other. Again and again they have entered the lists in a head-on confrontation. And again they have retired for a spell without either side reaching a final conclusion. Now let's think back for a moment, if we can, in regard to this. My mind was running back over that which we stated before, and I'll just repeat a little bit of it here briefly, of course. We regard and consider that the present time is the seventh great special day of opportunity in which the work can be finished. The first of those was back in the days of Joshua, as is spoken of by Paul in the fourth chapter of the book of Hebrews. "For if Joshua had given them rest," Paul says, "then would he not afterwards have spoken of another day, saying in David, 'Today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts.'" Now, with Joshua, God had so organized things there that the whole matter of the controversy could have been brought to a fairly quick conclusion. By the simple process of Israel being utterly faithful to God and spreading out and out and out until they covered the entire world, and sin just simply died out for want of a following. Now, let's bear this point in mind. In that very moment when there's not one sinner left upon this earth, Satan has lost the battle, finally. He can never reinstate himself upon this earth again. But, conversely, in that day when God no longer has a faithful soul left upon this earth, then whose triumph is complete? Satan's triumph is complete. Now, have you ever thought of the implications of those words in volume 5, I think it's page 473, where Sister White is talking about the march of the devil against the people of God? I'll just get you the exact page here. It is page 473 where it says, "But here is a little company who are resisting his supremacy." Now listen, if he could blot them from the earth, his triumph would be complete. Now if a person has a complete triumph, what does that mean? Yes, it means the victory. To what extent? It means the victory in the entire controversy, doesn't it? That's what it amounts to, because if Satan's triumph is complete, then it would mean that the victory is his in the entire controversy. Now, let's go back a moment to the very beginning and let's see what the controversy is all about. What is Satan's contention in regard to the law of God? We know that the whole controversy is over the law of God, right? We know that. Now, what does Satan claim in regard to that law? He says it can't be kept by whom? Created beings. So, it cannot be kept by created beings. Now, in the Garden of Eden, he came to two created beings. Well, now, first of all, I should mention this. In heaven, he came to a heaven full of created beings, the angels, and he succeeded in bringing one third of them over to his side. One third of them were not able to resist the power of sin and fell under the power of that sin. And the other two thirds, as we have seen before, were shaken, badly shaken by the power of sin, and they stood on the in the possibility of also yielding in good time. So what could Satan point to so far as heaven was concerned? Victory. Isn't that right? He could say, and he did say, and he points to the fallen angels as proof that created beings are not strong enough to resist the enticements of sin. Remember he said this in the book of Job, the 4th chapter. Let's go across there a moment in the charge of Eliphaz against Job. In Job 4 and verse 18, it says, "Behold, he put no trust in his servants, and his angels he charged with what? Folly." Or in our language, sin. So then the devil says to Eliphaz, "If that's so with the angels, how much less in them that dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, which are crushed before the moth," and so forth. Now when Adam sinned in the Garden of Eden, going down to this earth, what then did Satan say? Again he said, "There you are, the entire population of this earth has broken the law of God. Again, it has been proved in a single encounter." That's all it took, in one meeting. First of all with Eve, then a few minutes later with Adam. In one meeting, all it took was for man to meet sin head on, and man fell in the very first experience. Now of course, Satan felt he had won the battle then and the earth was his, but God came down to offer to man the very same salvation which God had previously offered to the devil and which the devil had refused to take. So Satan's contention then is this, that God's law is unjust, it cannot be kept by created beings, that the power of sin is greater than the power of evil, I'll be pardoned, than the power of righteousness. And so therefore, all down through history, Satan has been trying hard to crush out righteousness. And in that moment, when he succeeds in blotting out the last person upon the face of the earth who believes in God, in that moment, his triumph is complete. We come back to this morning's Sabbath school lesson again to Isaiah, the first chapter, and read there the statement of Isaiah. We read it this morning. I didn't pick it up then because I was saving it up for the service. In verse 9, Isaiah 1, verse 9. Now in the first 8 verses, Isaiah has been talking about the unbelievable corruption in ancient Judah and Benjamin. And then he says, "Except the Lord of hosts had left unto us a very small remnant, we should have been as Sodom, and we should have been likened to Gomorrah." Now in Isaiah's day, what was Sodom and Gomorrah? just a heap of ruins. A scorched and desolate and barren plain where I don't think anything grows even to this day. A place that's all pitch and slime because of the volcanic or whatever other action it was that burnt that place to ruin. In other words, Isaiah is recognizing the fact that if God had not had back at that time a tiny remnant of people, then Israel and in fact the entire world would have been reduced to the same conditions as Sodom and Gomorrah. Have you ever wondered why it is that God, right down through history, has never, ever been without at least a tiny stream? In other words, God has never seen the thing come to this point and can be completely cut off, and then God go over somewhere else and make a fresh beginning in another place? That's never been the picture, has it? The picture has always been that there's been an unbroken stream. Now, sometimes, if I can draw it this way, the stream narrows right down until it's so narrow you can hardly see it, like that. Then it gets big again. Then it narrows down again, like that. Up again and down again. But never, ever has Satan been able to wholly and completely cut that thing off. Now, if he could, then what? He'd have won. Now, that's serious, isn't it, when you think about it? And when you think of how thin that line was back there in the days of Isaiah, how thin that line was just a few years ago when this message came and the entire Adventist church turned against the truth, and but a few faithful people around, well, mainly in Australia and New Zealand for start, stood for the message, how thin it was, and then you begin to appreciate the investment that God had made in a movement so fragile and tiny as this one. And you begin to appreciate how much depended upon you and I sticking by this message then, and how much depends upon you and I sticking by this message in the future. Now here's a question too which has come clearer to me in the week which has passed. Over here in the impending conflict, I read in regard to Satan's activities. A statement which you know well, I'll read it again just the same. It says here that while appearing to the children of men, this is page 589, as a great physician who can heal all their maladies, he will bring disease and disaster until populous cities are reduced to ruin and desolation. Even now he is at work in accidents and calamities by sea and by land, in great conflagrations, terrible fires, in fierce tornadoes and terrific hailstorms, in tempests, floods, cyclones, tidal waves and earthquakes, in every place and in a thousand forms, Satan is exercising his power. He sweeps away the ripening harvest, and famine and distress follow. He imparts to the air a deadly taint, and thousands perish by the pestilence. These visitations are to become more and more frequent and disastrous. Destruction will be upon both man and beasts. The earth mourneth and fadeth away, the haughty people do languish. The earth also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant. Now that's a strange statement when you think about it, because back in the beginning, Satan said to the angels, follow me and I'll make you a better life than the life that you now have. And here Satan, as busy as can be, making life for his followers pretty miserable and pretty unhappy. After all said and done, when that great and fearful earthquake in Peru wrought its havoc just a few weeks ago, who suffered? Satan's people or God's people? Satan's people did, more than God's people. Then we don't know what was there, of course, in the way of God's folk, but we certainly know this, that thousands upon thousands of those who followed after Satan's rule perished in that thing and went into destruction. So it doesn't seem like a contradiction that Satan, who in the first case boasted that he would give to the angels and to those who followed him a better way of life, then busily as can be, goes around destroying his own people, their homes, their properties, their crops, their harvest, and floods them with disease. Now, is this a madness on Satan's part, or is there a studied purpose and intent in what he is doing? Very obviously, it's purposeful. He has a plan. Satan today is not concerned about making a better world. Satan is concerned only in saving his own skin. That's what he's out to save. He's concerned, and to save his own skin, he has to destroy righteousness in the world and destroy God's reputation. He gains from this activity a twofold dividend, a twofold repayment for his investment, which is as follows. In the first case, while he does this, of course, he blames God, or has mankind blame God for what he's doing. Don't you remember, of course, that in insurance policies, storms, floods, fires, cyclones, accidents, and so forth are called what? Yeah, the act of God, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, the act of God.
The act of God. And that is the underground fault, so far as mankind is concerned, that a fearful earthquake is the act of God. But it's not the act of God. It's the act of whom? Satan. So all right then, men hate God because of what he does to them. That's dividend number one. Dividend number two is this. So read on page 590. And then the great deceiver will persuade men that those who serve God are causing these evils. The class that have provoked the displeasure of heaven will charge all their troubles upon those whose obedience to God's commandments is a perpetual reproof to transgressors. It will be declared that men are offending God by the violation of the Sunday Sabbath, that this sin has brought calamities which will not cease until Sunday observance shall be strictly enforced. Now, today we are witnesses to what men will do by way of rioting when they are deprived of what they think to be their rights. We see it today in America, we see it in other countries around the world, and rioting is a pretty violent and fearful business, when life and property is just nothing so far as the rioter is concerned. However, rioting is kept under reasonable control because the powers of thee are able to exert a pressure or a force and to curb this thing after something of a struggle. But the time is coming when the entire world is going to be united in their complaint and suffering as they are deprived of the common necessities and comforts of ordinary everyday life. And bear in mind that that generation will be a generation growing up with no experience of want or deficiency or discomfort at all that they can name. Somebody asked the question, and appeared in print, I think in a Reader's Digest, what is the modern generation growing up going to tell their children? They did with that when they were youngsters. Well put, wasn't it? What is the modern generation growing up going to tell their children they did without when they were youngsters? And the answer is nothing. Now, of course, when you're accustomed to hardship, you can bear hardship. But when you're accustomed to comfort and ease, as the modern generation is, then when trouble and calamity comes, you're not going to bear it very well at all. And you can imagine the wrath and the rage of a world that Satan has led to blame the people of God for their troubles. Imagine their wrath against the people of God. And so Satan's second dividend is that he is building up today a weapon in the form of a disgruntled world population who will be combined in their fierce anger against a tiny minority who will be blamed for robbing the world of its prosperity. And this weapon in Satan's hands, he deems to be a master weapon with which to destroy the people of God off the face of the earth. Now, for 6,000 years, Satan has perpetuated his life by what means? By keeping righteousness from gaining full and complete victory. While Satan has never been able to wipe out the people of God completely and break the royal line, the line of righteousness, so there will never be any revival after that, at the same time, he has been able to stop the people of God from gaining complete victory on the other hand. And so, as I said, they've entered the lists again and again in head-on confrontation. Neither side has been able to take the thing right through to its conclusion, either God's people or the devil, and so they've had to retire and come back for a fresh battle, and come back for a fresh battle and a fresh battle again. But here is the point. Today, both sides are preparing for what they know will be the last battle, a battle to the very death. A battle in which both of the protagonists, righteousness on the one hand and evil on the other, will enter the lists for a struggle from which neither will withdraw until the one or the other is left, bloodied and dead upon the ground. From this struggle there will be no turning back. This time the battle is to go through its bitter and final conclusion. And whether we like it or not, terrifying as the prospect may be, we are the ones who irrevocably are being drawn into the lists for this great and final struggle. The symbolism of this is found in the Jordan River. There was the Jordan River before them, a flood. On the other side was the land of Canaan, which the Israelites had to go across and possess by battle.
God opened up that river and the people went across. And when they were across, what did the river do?
It closed up again and there was no way back. Now they had to go on, they had to fight, no matter what the cost could be. And likewise, when the image of the beast is set up, we as a people are going to have to go across that river, that Jordan River. The way back will be cut off and we have to go ahead and win or lose, we have to fight that battle. And you know, as I've stated the order of last day events, the picture is very clear. That not only will we enter that battle with this picture behind us, in which Satan has always succeeded in preventing God's work from going through, and what Sister White said in Westminster Ministers, page 473, that the prejudices and opinions prevailed. And again, Selected Messages, volume 1, says the enemy succeeded, Satan succeeded in that battle back in 1844. And it's going to look very much like to us at that time, as if the devil has succeeded again, only by dogged faith are we going to carry on and be victorious all the way through. Now the message by which the battle shall be won is the great threefold message of Revelation 14, 6 to 12. And that message is being introduced to us here in the 10th chapter of the book of Revelation. It's as we take hold upon that message, make it our very own experience, live in it, make it the counsel of our everyday lives, that we are ever going to be successful in the great battle which lies ahead of us at this time. Now, young people in this room today and anywhere else where this tape may go, you ought to do some very sober and some very, very serious thinking. Because you're not in this world to simply earn a living, to get married and raise a family. That may be part of the picture, of course. You're in this world as young men and young women of destiny. The young men and young women who come into this world at a time when this great last battle is to be fought, and when God will be depending upon you to be true and faithful to him in this great conflict. Like Queen Esther, you'll be called upon to go in before the king. And she went in not knowing whether she would live or whether she would perish. But bravely she went in saying, if I perish, I perish, but go in I must. And in she went. Now during the week the thought came to my mind as I thought about our young people growing up, that once again, as I said before, you have opportunities the like of which your parents never had. Opportunities which we have won for you in the recovery from the pit of darkness in which we found ourselves as young people. And the world is yet to see, and the church is yet to see, and heaven has yet to see what God can do in and for and through and by the army of young people who will today make the most of their opportunities. Now, when we got married, we had the spirit of poverty, I know, but we didn't have this message. Let's take just one facet of your future lives. You're getting married, no doubt, by and by, some of you. I'd like to challenge the young people who are growing up now to put away the books and the magazines and the other things which engross your attention, the radios and whatnot, and go to the Spirit of Prophecy today and from here on out and read what God has said to you in regard to how to conduct a successful courtship for a start. And then, how to be successful parents. How to discipline your children. How to organize a home. How to run the home finances. Go and learn those things before you even get a boyfriend or a girlfriend, as the case may be. We didn't do it. We should have. But we've won ground for you young people where you have a higher start than we had. And we can testify from the blessings which we have gained just what God will give you by way of blessing and happiness and fulfillment if you will endure the discipline of this kind of study. It's up to you, of course. Your parents are busy. They can't read it to you. They've got responsibilities. We've got responsibilities which preclude our giving to you the personalized attention we would like to give and would give if we only had the time. And then extend your study into every other phase of Christian living, into health, into dress, into Sabbath keeping, into Christian liberality, systematic benevolence, into missionary service, and make yourself so familiar with the pattern of living that will make the army of God in the last days, that when God calls upon young men and young women of strength to stand like Daniel and Joseph and Elijah, he'll have them, not just one or two here and there, not a lone champion, a lone faithful man like John the Baptist in his day or Isaiah in his day, but an army of young people with their enthusiasm, with their strength, and with their respect for the wisdom of those who have gone before, but whose strength and energy is declining. We are today about to enter upon a do or die conflict. and let's face the fact, it's going to take young men and young women of extraordinary capabilities and character to win that fight. Never in the past has God found that army yet. He didn't find it in Joshua's day. They didn't go all the way. Nor in David's day, nor again during the 490 years, and even the mighty apostolic church failed to measure up to what God had in mind for them. They came short of the victory. Now, we admire the apostles, don't we? You think about those men, men who walked with Jesus, men who witnessed day by day his life of self-sacrifice and ministry. We admire them as great men and privileged men and talented men. And they were that. But they failed to go all the way through with the work which God gave to them to do. Therefore, understand, young people and older ones too, we're not going to drift into God's kingdom. We have to develop and cultivate every gift and every power which God has given to us, and we shall only do it by making these books the man of our counsel. God has given us the pattern. It's now up to us to take that word and make it our very own, so we shall gain the victory in these last days. And so today, we'll leave this study of Revelation 10 at this point, more or less as an introduction to it. The challenge of this mighty hour to our young people and the believers in this message is this. Can you see and realize that we are about to enter upon a do-or-die conflict, wherein if we fail, we perish, and Satan's triumph will be complete? That we're entering upon a conflict where this tiny remnant, and that's all we are, has to gain the victory which no previous church upon the earth has ever gained. Now, isn't that a frightening responsibility? A staggering prospect? Now, we know the victory is going to be gained by some people, sometime, somewhere. Let's pray God we're that people. And we can be, and God expects us to be, and God has called us to be that people. But we're not going to be that people by indolence, by carelessness, and by unfaithfulness. We're going to be it if only we put God first in everything. And nothing is to be allowed to stand between us and his service. No sacrifice too great, no study too arduous, no effort too much. I pray God today that we shall gain a vision. I've gained something of a vision during this past week as I've written out these studies on the order of last day events. And seen something of the controversy, I've never seen it before. And I trust as you read those same articles as they come out month by month over the next 4 months, that you'll gain the same vision and realize where we stand and what we must be in order to win that battle. And then if we shall do our part, God will do his, the victory will be won, Satan will be vanquished, and at last we shall find our place in the eternal kingdom. May God bless us at this hour to be that people and to experience that victory and to be of the 144,000 is my prayer for Jesus' sake.